Tom Weber on NPR News. We're going to look now at the year after prison. My colleague Laura Ewan has spent more than a year following the story of a man who has spent more than half of his life in prison. When Elizer Darris was locked up, he was just 15. He had committed murder, and he was released from prison a year ago after, again, spending more than half of his life there. We're going to start off this conversation with Laura Ewan's story that followed Elizer's journey to find out what it's been like for him to re-enter a world he had left as a troubled teen.
Elizer Darris is the very picture of a fresh start.
You can grab some chairs for us.
He greets me at his South Minneapolis apartment in a creased button-down, dark-washed jeans, closely cropped hair. It's his first full day out, and he's already gotten rid of all of his prison clothes.
It's in the trash, actually. I think he's taken it, just tossed it. Shoes, shirts, socks. It's gone.
Darris left the free world as an eighth grader. He's returning as a 32-year-old. He and his wife, Shondell, are sitting on a couch in their living room. They got married while he was in prison. So now they're finally reunited. They're kind of like newlyweds, living under the same roof for the first time. But Darris says everything feels natural.
I'm just happy to be here. Happy to be free. Happy to have woken up with a lot of natural light in my apartment. It's a beautiful apartment. I have a beautiful wife.
Just yesterday, Shondell picked him up. After 17 years behind bars, Darris wasted no time with an emotional scene. He says his first words to his wife were,
"Let's go."
Yes, really fast.
I said, "Let's go." I almost had to put my hand in the nape of her back and push her forward. Did I even turn around and look at it again?
No, I thought you'd like want to go outside and like look at the trees and nature, and you were like, "No."
Trees and nature.
Even though it's a prison, it has a really beautiful landscape.
No, I didn't want to see the trees. I didn't want to see the birds. I wanted to see the road.
He says he worried that, like, maybe the prison guards would realize there'd been a mistake and order him back to his cell. After all, Darris almost never made it out. He was what they call a lifer. After the murder, Darris was certified as an adult and originally sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Today, there are 34 offenders serving life sentences in Minnesota who were juveniles when they committed their crimes. Darris appealed a first-degree murder charge and won. A second-degree murder charge stuck, and he was resentenced to 25 years. In Minnesota, with good time, inmates can be let out after serving two-thirds of their sentence and finish the remaining third on supervised release. So after 17 years in prison, when Darris was released, he wasn't about to look back. But getting here was a long time coming.
No, I was a terrible inmate. Terrible. I had plenty of fights.
When Darris entered prison, he hadn't finished the eighth grade. He had a quick temper. He says he spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, or what he calls the hole. And it was in the hole at the St. Cloud prison a few years into his sentence when...
I remember we were in having a riot. And
you were in the riot?
I was leading the riot.
Darris says the inmates were starting fires, shaking bars, doing what he calls unspeakable things, like throwing cartons of bodily fluids at corrections officers. He could get a glimpse of the chaos from the tiny horizontal slat of his cell.
I remember being in this riot, watching a fire burn in front of my cell, thinking to myself, yeah, I never felt so free in my life. I feel free watching this thing burn down.
But the feeling of freedom shifted to a feeling of suffocation. Smoke billowed into his cell.
And then I remember shaking the doors and saying, "Turn the fans on! Turn them fans on!" And so here I am, yelling and screaming at the same COs who we were attacking to virtually save my life now, right?
And it wasn't just the smoke. Darris had flooded his cell by repeatedly flushing the toilet. There was toilet water everywhere.
So I had to hit the deck as the smoke was coming down. And then I remember on the ground thinking to myself, I don't want to die like this. I haven't done nothing with my life.
How old were you then?
Maybe 19. I was 19. You know, and I just had a wake of destruction. You know, and I found myself laying in a little bitty cell in a little bitty town I never heard of, in a little bitty prison, in toilet water. I just didn't want to die like that. That was a critical turning point, you know, in which I decided to just kind of like get it together.
For one thing, he started paying attention to older inmates who had reached out to mentor him.
Well, I gave some tough love. I told him that my time is valuable.
That's Willie Lloyd, who was also incarcerated for murder when he took Darris under his wing.
I think the light was starting to come on for him. And I can see that he wanted something more.
And Elizer Darris did want something more. While incarcerated, Darris got his GED, a point of pride that he talked about years later when he accepted his Associate of Arts degree at the Stillwater Prison.
Please join me in welcoming Elizer Darris.
If you haven't gathered by now, Darris can tell a story. He was selected to speak at his college graduation ceremony back in 2015.
Good morning, everyone.
He talked about how when he was incarcerated at 15, he figured he would spend the rest of his natural life in prison. That's actually what the sentencing judge told him. But the education he got behind bars led him to believe his future was changing.
I opened up this envelope and I pulled my GED out. And I remember running my finger across the elevated letters over my name, and three words rocketed through my body. I did it.
Yes, yes. I did it. He says that GED filled him with a kind of pride that saved his life. It told him he still had worth, and that confidence would carry him to newer heights. But it's tough to reconcile Eli Darris, the person, with the very worst act of his life. We'll need to back up to 1998. Darris was 14, living near St. Louis. He was flunking out of school, getting into fights. He didn't know who his dad was. He was angry. He says he attempted suicide. Then a carnival came through town.
I was walking down the Midway with some friends, and, you know, one of the carnival guys asked if we wanted to, you know, run the joint. And I said, sure.
So Darris ran away twice to join the carnival. And this crew had criminal elements, similar to a gang. At one point, while traveling near East Grand Forks, Minnesota, Darris says he realized another carnival worker, a man in his 40s named Cornelius Rogers, had stolen some of his money. Darris and another worker drove with Rogers out into the countryside. Court documents say Darris struck Rogers in the head three times with a tire jack. They left his body in a ditch. I reached out to the victim's family, and they expressed disbelief that Darris could ever change after committing such a brutal crime. Cornelius Rogers' brother-in-law, Kenneth Connolly, didn't know Darris had been released.
I can't accept that. The picture, it don't look right. I don't care if you're 13, 14, if you commit a murder like he committed at 15 years old and you out at 32, come on.
Elizer Darris says he doesn't expect the family to forgive him or to believe he deserves a second chance. He says all he can do is focus on doing right, not just for himself and his family, but for his whole community.
And in hope, not demand, but hope that people would see that and that his family members would see the absolute effort that I have put in and that I do continue to put in order to make things different.
Darris says he won't let the worst mistake of his life define him. And in his first year out, he says, his story is just beginning. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
You can find more on that story online at nprnews.org. Well, now joining me in the studio is Elizer Darris, who you heard there in that story. Eli, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Outstanding. Well, thank you for having me.
And Shane Price is here as well. He's with the Power of People Leadership Institute, which is in North Minneapolis. He goes into prisons in Rush City, Lino Lakes, and Faribault, and works with inmates before being released. And I see here on your card here, Shane, that the program you are director of is called the Replanting Program, which I think is a pretty fitting name that we're going to talk to. So thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be with you.
Eli, as you listen to that story again, I was really taken by the line there from the man who you killed, and I think it was his cousin. I can't remember exactly who that was, but you know, the idea that you could never change. And I think you talk about this now. You do some motivational speaking. You speak to groups. And I get why you understand why that person thinks you can never change. But in general, what do you say about just that belief that's out there that if you kill someone, you can never change?
Well, my life is a living testimony to the fact that you know, someone could make a horrible decision that could have lasting ramifications. And that same person, if given the right guidance, taught the right principles, have some information that is disrupting him from living a good life poured out of him,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and have good, wholesome information poured back inside that same person who made a horrible decision could be the same person that could save a life. Coming from the same person, just mm-hmm. like the same earth that we're able to extract poisons from, it's the same earth that we are able to extract medicines to heal from. It all depends on what is being cultivated. And for me personally, I've had the opportunity to be cultivated by men and women of towering character over many years to pull a lot of darkness out of me and pour a lot of light inside of me. And it's that same light that has been given to me that I feel compelled to share with others, because I've seen how that level of instruction, that level of insight, and that level of guidance can help take someone from where I was, for instance, mm-hmm. to where I am now.
What would it have been like if you had come to this studio, and I didn't have this job 17 years ago, but let's just play around with that for a minute. If you'd been in the studio the week before you committed that murder, what kind of guy were you? What kind of interview would this be? Would you be, I don't know, as thoughtful? What do you think that would be like?
Well, I would have been a teenager.
Yeah.
So I certainly probably would not have been thoughtful. I've actually am doing a lot of training and teaching with teenagers now. And so, yeah, so I probably wouldn't have been as thoughtful. Mm-hmm. You would have gotten a young man full of energy, full of excitement, full of belief in what he could or couldn't do, full of a lot of bravado. And honestly, I really can't tell you where the conversation would have went. That's the mind of a child, really. And so
sure.
I have no clue where young Eli would have taken this, this interview.
Shane, I can't remember if this is the exact stat. I think when I've had the Department of Commissions or the Department of Corrections commissioner here, I think this is the number. It's 95%. 95% of people who go into prison will come out.
Absolutely.
And that's just a piece of data I don't think people necessarily realize. What is the biggest barrier that you see facing someone the day they walk out? We heard in the story there, Eli said, "Get in the car, we're going."
Right.
But you know, once you get home, maybe you have maybe some friends come over, maybe a little party. Day or two later, right?
Sure.
It gets real.
It gets real.
How does it get real?
Well, let me say this to that. Part of what we do as the Power of People, personal development and leadership training organization and institution, is we go inside and help you get free there. And we really believe that if you want to stay free, as your question suggests,
mm-hmm.
that you have to get free inside.
Hmm.
And so that's the foundation for our teaching inside, is that you can change right now. We're not waiting around for someone to parole you.
Right.
And we're not waiting around for somebody to give you permission to be a better man.
That's right.
It's right now, and mm-hmm. that you can be a better man today, and that these things are a part of your personal responsibility. But if you don't understand yourself as a person
mm-hmm.
and really unpack that, which our training does, then you can't make necessary and important changes for yourself, and you can't have empathy and compassion for someone else because you don't understand them either. So once our guys, Eli being one, and Willie Lloyd being another, who we heard earlier in the tape, who's also doing an excellent job, by the way, once those guys start to appreciate what does it really mean to be a person and what are the responsibilities, the huge responsibilities that we have to one another. Mm-hmm. What do those look like and what's your role there? And you would be surprised, Tom, as I was probably 14 years ago when we started this, you would be surprised that the lights begin to turn on inside. Having said that, and to your question, Eli, I saw those lights coming on for him. He was already on a path when we met probably 8 or 9 years ago. But we stayed with one another for those 8 or 9 years and helped his forward progress and some of the mentorship that Willie Lloyd indicated he was providing and others. We helped to give him a clearer picture of what the good life could be for him. And so in the process of that, we trained Eli to become a leader inside. First, we develop you as a person. Mm-hmm. And then we begin to train you as a leader. And all of that needs to take place inside of the institution so that when you leave, you've already made some changes in who that person is who comes by, mm-hmm. how long you spend with them. We get down into minutes. How many minutes do you allow a subtractor or a divider to be in your life? Yep. What's your job there? What's your responsibility? So we say in 90 seconds, you can determine who the person is in front of you. That person has 90 seconds to demonstrate to you that he or she is an adder or a multiplier. And if in that 90 seconds you don't get that vibe and that feeling, even if you present it, then you need to move around.
And so when that happens, yep. and you free people, and you're, it's amazing. I didn't realize it's been 8 years. When you met Shane 8 years ago, did you know what your out date was?
I had an out date.
You had an out date, mm-hmm. but it was 7 years away.
Right.
Yep.
Right? I mean,
more than 7 years.
But yeah. More than 7 years. But to think about, you're going to work with this man for 7 years before he leaves prison?
Absolutely.
He's worked with some people longer than that.
Yeah. It's just, it's very stark to me because when I hear a replanting program, and I feel like when you think about it from the policy standpoint, something like that would be set up for those last 6 months.
Sure.
And I think there are. I think in those last 6 months, they're not. You're shaking your head. But you know what I mean? Like, there are some things like, okay, right. you're about 6 months away. You got to start right. learning how to do these things. But you're talking about 7 years.
Right.
Well, if I can address that, mm-hmm. I think the last 6 months is when the transition department of the Department of Correction kicks in mm-hmm. and begins to pay your transition possibilities a lot more interest. And yes, that is critical. However, if you haven't got it done in those last 6 months, mm-hmm. It's going to be hard for you when you come out for the reasons that you suggested, that you may not be prepared for what it means to be a person
right.
on the other side of the wall.
Did you want to add something to that, Eli?
Oh, no. He's doing great. I totally agree. if you've been incarcerated for a number of years and it is now coming down to the last few months to prepare for your eventual release, whereas 90-some-odd percent mm-hmm. Of people incarcerated will be released. If you're waiting to the last few months to begin those preparatory steps to get out, it's too late.
Mm.
That's too late.
That's so interesting.
That's not just too late. It's extraordinarily too late.
Do you think that's why... What's the stat here? 4 out of 10 released prisoners are rearrested during the first year back out. Do you think it's, Shane, because of what Eli was talking about? They didn't do enough preparation before they left? Or is it the other stuff we haven't even talked about? You can be all prepared, and you can do all the preparing you want, Shane, for these men. And do you work with women, too? I don't know if you work with
just the men,
just the men for now. But you can do all this work with these men, and then they get out, and they don't have a driver's license.
Right.
They can't get a job.
Sure.
They can't find housing.
Absolutely.
So are we doing here, right? You work for 7 years with them, and then they fall flat on their face, right?
Let me mention, I think, that a piece that's critical to this discussion is that having done good preparation and then come into your county of commit, so where your crime was committed at is often where you will be residing. And so our organization has had to learn the energy, the spirit, and the expectations of those handlers on the outside, i.e. POs and ISR, intensive supervised release agents. We've had to learn what those dynamics are so that we can inform our guy, because now someone else is entering into the process whose expectations could be built on his own theology, and we have to figure out how to merge those things together for success. That plays a role. But we teach to that inside, mm-hmm. that your PO or your agent is critical to you, and your ability to communicate to him or her correctly and giving them the opportunity to manage you doesn't take away your power. It just recognizes their authority over your behavior for a specific time. Now, I save that to say this, and this is the greater point. The vast majority of offenders in Minnesota don't go back for committing new crimes. I think there were only 300 some odd that went back last year. The entire state of Minnesota is really actually an excellent statistic. But about 3,000 individuals went back, a little more than that, last year for committing technical violations. And it's really time, the technical violation, that gives us a little more angst. And that is where this knowing who the handlers are and how to approach them and how to create good relationships really comes in and does play a role in success. If we waited for those last 6 months to begin to train mm-hmm. and come back out into this scenario where there is some apprehension based on your crime, mm-hmm. Eli's in, yep. mm-hmm. Is certainly one where you have to prove and demonstrate that you are someone else, as he has indicated. And I think certainly, and I'll close by saying this, certainly our organization has been allowed to teach to those issues that help our guys, pop guys, we call ourselves, become a little more successful than the general population who would begin to prepare for their release at a six-month timeline.
Shane Price is with me from the Power of People Leadership Institute. Eli Darris is here in studio as well. You heard Eli's story there from Laura Ewan. It's on nprnews.org as well. We have about 10 minutes left here. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm really trying to get at this question. I'm going to ask Eli this next. What do people listening need to know don't understand, if they've not been in this situation, about the challenges and barriers that are out there during that first year after release? If you have a thought on that, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1, and please don't call or text if you're driving. And I am going to focus on the challenges first, Eli, because that's against the law, by the way. Sure. I do want to focus on the challenges first, Eli, because I always think that potentially there's a mayor or a city council member or a state lawmaker listening who might actually have some power to change what you're about to say or address this issue. So what are the kinds of things that I, as someone who's never been in prison, just don't get about that first year?
Yeah, I tell you, one of the challenges that I actually encountered, and it blew me away, because I spent a lot of time preparing for release. I spent a lot of time developing relationships and building networks. What shocked me the most was how difficult it was to acquire housing. I was just so shocked. The Department of Corrections, and from what I've heard, they have taken steps to correct this, but at the time that I was in there a year ago, there was a list that was passed around with so-called felony-friendly landlords. And almost to a landlord that I called on the list, either the question was, how did you get my number? What list am I on? Tell them to take me off of that list. Or it was just overt hostility. They didn't ask what the crime was or anything like that. What they knew was that I was incarcerated, so I obviously had a felony.
So they didn't even know you had committed murder?
Oh, no. They didn't know anything about me. They just knew that because I was calling from prison. This was a list of felony-friendly landlords.
And when you get the call, it's you have a call from
you. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's what the phone call starts.
And so
right?
They already know. But I'm coming into the conversation thinking that because they're on a list, that this would be a much friendlier conversation, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we would be able to move forward. I was not able to move forward in almost no conversation. I was so blown away. Mm-hmm. I called nearly 20 landlords, and I did not get an affirmative response from any one of them. I was so shocked. And so housing is certainly an issue. The Department of Corrections, when I was being released, actually made a decision to cut some of the programs that allow for you to get your permit to be able to, you know, begin driving. And so I had missed that programmatic cutoff point in which you were no longer able to take the test in there. And so logistically, it just became a little more difficult to figure out, you know, how to kind of navigate all of that. Whereas I could have done that while I was on the other side of the wall.
It's interesting, Shane, and we don't have to figure out the answer to this point. And your training actually doesn't get into this debate. But to what Eli said, I totally get why a landlord taking a call from, where were you? Were you at
Stillwater?
Stillwater. This is a call from Stillwater Prison. Sure. I totally get if I'm a landlord.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to let this guy live in my building, right?
Absolutely.
So what do we do from there?
And what I think is so interesting was that Eli's expectation was that individuals on this list were going to respond to you differently. And I just find that, you know, even a further part of your own growth and development.
Right.
You get it.
But from a policy standpoint, I can't pass a law that says a private landlord must allow a convicted felon to live there, right? I can't do that necessarily.
There are some felony-friendly landlords who are in some of these communities and some around the state of Minnesota. So let's just, and we're grateful to them if any of you
are
listening.
We are grateful to them.
The Power of People, a personal development leadership organization, have had to become property managers ourselves for the very reason that Eli has indicated, because we have a guy who's totally trained now. We believe in that and think that he's ready to become a tax-paying Minnesotan, a good citizen, a father, and be reentered and replanted, I should say, but no housing. And so really, by self-defense, my wife and I, Dr. Verna Cornelia Price, we had to figure for that and created a couple of houses where we provide housing only for offenders who are coming back and only for offenders who are graduates from our program inside.
So you're actually also actually a landlord too.
It was a self-defense move,
right? But in the world of nonprofits,
absolutely,
right, you were set up to do this one thing, you find this other thing isn't working, so you have to become a landlord.
Absolutely.
What's the change? How do you change it so that the next nonprofit that starts doesn't also have to become a landlord?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom, and I don't have the magic answer. I will say this, that if you're listening and you are an individual who is interested in helping a population, and that a population that's been trained in a way that you hear Brother Eliza Darius has been trained, we have those guys, and we've got some more like him, and they're on their way. And you can contact us, Power of People Personal Development Leadership Institute at 763-535-5711. We would love to talk to you.
I will tweet that out as well. I'll put I'll put the phone number on Twitter there. As well as we talked to Shane Price and Eli. Darius, were you going to add something to what he just said?
No. We have guys that are absolutely trained up. We call ourselves POP guys, and we are absolutely trained up. Some of us are involved in pretty extraordinary things, myself included. And so, you know, on the surface, while you may think to yourself, oh, I'm taking a call from a prison, I'm taking an extraordinary risk.
Right.
In reality, by opening up the door and allowing someone in, especially someone who has been trained up, that belief that you have that you're taking an extraordinary risk could be the best decision that you've ever made in your life. For instance, any employer who was able to get me on their team to be part of their organization or part of whatever they're doing, they got everything that I could give. I poured myself inside, mm-hmm. and they've gotten someone who was well trained up to be able to really move the agenda of what they were trying to do forward. Whereas now I'm able to fly around the country and speak at colleges, yeah. speak at universities. I'm a board member of a multi-million-dollar nonprofit organization. I've created my own consulting company, whereas I'm going in doing leadership training and leadership development in nonprofits and for-profits across the city and soon actually across the country. I'm in the process of developing a leadership training for McDonald's Corporation owner who has 15 chains.
And wants to hire people with records. Is that the idea?
The idea is
owner could then someday say, sure. Well, yeah, I want to hire felons.
Well,
right?
Well, hopefully that's the idea. But the idea in his instant situation is that he wants to increase his retention rate and have his employees just be a little bit more effective. I have been trained by Shane Price and others to help develop leadership capacities within people. And so, yes, it may seemingly seem like a risk bringing someone on board, but it may actually be one of the best decisions that someone has ever made.
For what it's worth, I had a conversation a few years ago. We were talking about something related to the criminal justice system, and someone who used to work at Stillwater, I don't think he was a warden, but he was an officer, I'm not sure, he said, look, for what it's worth, to your example, Eli, he says, if I had my pick of people to work with or places to work, it's with the murderers, because the murderers are the best behaved and they have the lowest rate of recidivism, because you go on the theory that the act, the crime was an act of passion, and that was all expelled in that moment, and so that you live the rest of your life with that hanging over you, even though there are statistics that suggest otherwise.
Well, as a matter of fact, Tom, that statistic does bear itself out relevant to reoffending. You know, that population has about a 1% rate of reoffense, and it's never, you know, germane to the original crime. I would just say this in closing, that you know, the Power of People Personal Development Leadership Institute is so very proud of Eli's progress. There are other men who are listening. We're also very proud of you. There is an opportunity for a second chance.
Yep.
1 out of 4 Minnesotans has a criminal record, but 4 out of 4 Minnesotans has a criminal history. We're all in this together, and we need to join forces.
Thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it.